This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The number of applications to open charter schools has jumped significantly since the charter school cap was lifted in 2011. There used to be a couple dozen applications per year. This year, 156 groups plan to apply, and that means a whole lot of work for the people who review them. Lisa Miller reports.
Joel Medley is in charge of the office that oversees all of the state's charter schools. This year, he expected to hear from a lot of groups wanting to open schools, but not quite this many.
When I saw 156, the first thing that I thought of, how are we going to process all of these?
Medley thought there was no way his staff of four could review all these applications by themselves. After all, an application can easily run 100 pages. So he decided to recruit some educators to help screen them before handing them off to the Charter Advisory Council.
Once we get those remarks in from the screeners, we will go back through each of those. That's going to afford the council the opportunity of having two sets of eyes that have been on every application as it moves forward.
The council's job is to tell the State Board of Education which groups deserve a charter. If all 156 applications look good, the council can tell the State Board to approve all of them. So the Advisory Council goes through its own screening process.
The last time around, I spent about 3 hours per application reading them and kind of digesting them.
That's the council's chairman, John Betterton. He's also the principal of Bethel Hill Charter School. To speed up the process, council members have put a page limit on the applications. They've also gotten a 2-month extension from the State Board of Education to review them.
It's going to be a taxing process, and I think if that continues, the legislature is going to have to appropriate some kind of funding or some kind of support there.
After all, Betterton points out, it's a lot easier to deny a bad application than close a school once it's up and running. I'm Lisa Miller in Charlotte.
This is the Down East Journal.
My life has been enriched, my heart held at bay, when we're together in that special way. Help me to hear what your heart has to say, not being selfish, wanting my way.
He graduated from high school barely knowing how to read, but in his mid-40s decided he would attempt one more time to learn to read. Today we hear the inspiring story of Earl Mills. Since reading his first book at 48 years old, he has read 80 books and published two of his own as an advocate for adult literacy. Earl Mills was born in eastern North Carolina into a large sharecropper family. He had 10 sisters and 3 brothers. Out of the 14 children, only half of them graduated from high school, including Earl.
My father could not read. He dropped out in the 7th grade to help with support the family. My mother could read and write well. She completed the 11th grade.
School was a struggle for Earl. He was held back in the 3rd grade because the teacher noticed he was having difficulty reading. All throughout his schooling, Earl did his best to mask his shortcoming.
You would rather act out and be sent to the principal's office rather than to go up in front of the class and for your secret and the shame of being embarrassed in front of your peers.
Earl would often receive help with schoolwork from his mother and older siblings. Despite his illiteracy, he always had a way with words.
The unawed hen squeaks, echoing through a silhouette of light of mother's shadow cast upon her children's faces. Just another day, like all the rest, she leaves to toil for others, leaving her own to fend for themselves.
As her hands turn,
the first thing that I remember writing was in the 7th grade. The teacher asked the class to write a poem or a story, and being from the country, idea of squirrels came to my mind. So I wrote a poem about squirrels, and my teacher thought that I had gotten the poem out of a book.
In high school, after being warned he was in danger of flunking senior English, Earl says he worked harder and eventually graduated from Jasper High School in New Bern in 1971.
To the day, I can't figure out why I kept going knowing that I couldn't read.
After high school, Earl worked a variety of jobs in eastern North Carolina, including brick masonry, railroad construction, and boat building at Hatteras Yachts. He was successful in his endeavors and offered many promotions, but was unable to accept them because he couldn't read or write.
Joined a local church and was going through a 14-week discipleship class. with 8 or 10 people in the class, including my wife. And I would always pretend that I couldn't find the scriptures.
One evening, the pastor, not knowing Earl couldn't read, called on him to share a verse. He said flashbacks of his childhood came rushing back.
Fear gripped my heart. My wife sitting beside of me, trying to whisper the words in my ear. I was embarrassed, and there was a young lady in church that knew about Craven Literacy Council.
At age 45, Earl sought help at the Craven Literacy Council, where he was assessed at a second-grade reading level. He was assigned a tutor that began teaching him basic reading and writing skills.
When you can't read, you keep that secret under lock and a key. And now, at a man of 45 years old, sitting across the desk, letting someone in, even into a deeper part of that you have kept under lock and a key, it was real embarrassing.
After 2.5 years, Earl was still struggling, and his tutor ended up moving away.
At that time, I purposed in my heart that this is it's not working. I'm gonna give it up. And Craven Literacy Council signed me a second tutor, Mr. Alfred Seamster. And he called and would call the house and call the house. I'd listen to the message on the machine, but I wouldn't pick up. And I said, he's not going to quit calling. So one day I picked the phone up. And he didn't say hello or anything. He just said, are you going to do this or not?
Earl met with this new tutor once a week for an hour and studied on his own to sharpen his literary skills. 6 months under Seamster's tutelage, he was given a 121-page book called Along the Gold Rush Trails.
And when he handed me the book, he could tell I was hesitant. So he said, try to read half the book. So I took the book home that Thursday night in my recliner. I opened the book, and I read the first word, the first line, the first paragraph, the first page. All of that hard work, all those phonics began to click. And at the age of 48, I read my first book.
Reading his first book gave Earl the confidence to read other books and to begin writing his own poetry.
It has opened up worlds that you wouldn't believe. I couldn't leave that note on the refrigerator letting someone know that I had to go somewhere. I could write a love note to my wife, you know. Can you imagine that? A lot of the weight that was on my shoulder for all those years is finally lifted.
Earl was recently assessed at Craven Literacy Council with a 10th grade reading level, but he strives to challenge himself with more advanced literature. He has read classics, including To Kill a Mockingbird, The Diary of Anne Frank, and A Lesson Before Dying. One of his favorites is A Teacher Who Could Not Read by John Cochran.
He graduated high school, college, and taught English for 17 years and then built a multi-million-dollar business and could not read and walked into a literacy council at 48 because he could not read a children's book to his daughter.
Earl is all too familiar with the shame and embarrassment of being illiterate. Now he wants to inspire others to learn how to read and write. In 2011, he published his first book, From Illiterate to Poet, and about a year later, a second book titled From Illiterate to Author. His books include poems and short stories about literacy, his devotion to his wife, and even the poem about squirrels from seventh grade.
Some of my poems I wrote in 12 minutes, some in days, some took months.
The poem Backdoor took Mills 3 years to write because he wanted to communicate the segregation of our country during the early part of the 20th century without being offensive. Here's an excerpt from that poem.
The back door was so hard to open, for it held the belittlement of my kind. It shackled our will, our soul, our mind. The back door was designed, engineered, and put in place. Its purpose was to dishonor, belittle, and disgrace, so we would never forget our place.
If you or someone you know needs help with literacy skills, contact your local literacy council. If you would like to volunteer to teach people how to read, there's a new tutor training workshop being held March 12th through the 26th at the Craven Literacy Council in New Bern. You can find more information at publicradioeast.org under the Events tab. Jared Brumbaugh, Public Radio East. As part of our Black History Month series, today we explore the ethnicity and little-known history of the author of The Count of Monte Cristo, The Man in the Iron Mask, and The Three Musketeers. L.C. Morris speaks with Tom Reese, the author of The Black Count, Glory Revolution, Betrayal, and The Real Count of Monte Cristo. He tells us of the systematic removal of race from this famous father and son.
They share the same name, Alexandre Dumas. A father and a son. The father a trailblazer, the son a well-known author. Their ethnic identities shunned because they did not fit the conventional narrative.
The writer actually tried writing The Count of Monte Cristo with all black and mixed race characters. And that book still exists today. The novel is called George. You know, that's basically also his father's life. But he tried doing it where the character is a mixed-race man suffering from the same racial insults as his father. When that book came out, the world wasn't ready for it, and it didn't catch on.
Alexandre Dumas, author of the classics The Count of Monte Cristo, The Three Musketeers, and The Man in the Iron Mask, based these compositions on his father's life. Alexandre Dumas was one of the greatest swordsmen in Europe, a leader who outranked Napoleon, leading armies up the Alps and across the deserts of Egypt while serving in the French Army and the French Revolutionary Army.
Alex Dumas was a kind of super soldier of the 18th century, maybe the greatest. You know, some people have, since my book came out, said that he's the greatest forgotten soldier. But he was this incredible man. And right before, at the end of his life, he gave birth to a son, and that son turned out to be this brilliant writer. And he grew up to write some of the best-known novels in history, most notably, as you mentioned, The Count of Monte Cristo and The Three Musketeers. And really, when you look at the novelists, it's really his autobiography, these memoirs, it's his autobiography. When you look at that, you see he's basing all of his adventure heroes on his own father.
Alex Dumas' extraordinary life and character survived only in the literary works of his son, who, like his father, had been whitewashed. Napoleon had Dumas' image removed from a famous painting of the Egyptian expedition and replaced with a blonde, blue-eyed officer. And the younger Dumas was acknowledged publicly only by name. Born the son of a French count and a black slave, Dumas Sr. went on to become the first black general in French history and remains the highest-ranking person of color of all time in a continental European army. America would not see this achievement from a black until 1989 with General Colin Powell. Dumas, the author, have captivated millions of readers worldwide. In the book, The Black Count, Glory, Revolution, Betrayal, and The Real Count of Monte Cristo, Tom Reese brings the overlooked lives of Dumas the Conqueror and Dumas the Writer out of the shadows.
I actually was such a fan of Dumas that I read his memoirs when I was a kid, and the amazing thing about his memoirs is that the first 200 pages aren't about his life at all. They're all about the life of his father. And the life of his father reads like a combination of The Three Musketeers and The Count of Monte Cristo, only more unlikely and outlandish and crazy.
Reese continues with enthusiasm.
I loved adventure books, but I also loved history. And I couldn't believe that I could not find this story in any of the history books, that this true life hero on the level of all of The Three Musketeers combined had actually existed, that he had been, you know, African-American in a white world, and et cetera, et cetera. I couldn't believe that this hadn't been written about, and I was always kind of, frankly, intrigued to know how much of it was true or if it was true, and so I always had this story in my back pocket.
6 years of research led Reese all over the world, verifying all of the adventures of the larger-than-life hero within the memoirs of the renowned author Alexandre Dumas.
I was really piecing this story together from scratch, so I went all around everywhere that Alex Dumas had ever lived or campaigned, and I followed his armies up to places on the top of the Alps where he'd been stationed on a glacier, and in fact, on top of the Alps, I found inside a church
bell tower, this incredible painting of him when he was accepting the surrender of the Austrian troops there on the middle of the glacier, surrounded by snow and thousands of his guys. I followed him all through Italy. I followed him down into Egypt. And wherever I went, I was finding documents, but I also found engravings.
General Dumas' life was deliberately made to be forgotten, not only because he had crossed the powerful and ruthless Napoleon, but he also crossed history.
Alex Dumas challenged Napoleon and said, you know, how dare you destroy our revolution in personal quest for power like this? This is not what we've been fighting for. And in fact, I think it was those confrontations that happened in Egypt when they were both in the desert, when Dumas was the cavalry commander of the French forces and Napoleon was the supreme commander, and they clashed. And the fact that here was this man publicly challenging him, and then also the fact that he was a black man, and Napoleon clearly had problems with that, it was too much for him. Napoleon really determined to crush Dumas.
Blacked out in history, rather whited out, paintings of the general were altered.
The greatest paintings of him that exist cannot be found anymore, partly because Napoleon decided to erase his identity. So during the Egyptian campaign, when Dumas had been head of the French cavalry, had ridden across Egypt from to take in Cairo, and they painted this amazing painting, and you find descriptions of it, of him in Cairo, and Napoleon ordered it to be painted over and said, paint the black man out and paint a blonde, blue-eyed cavalry officer in his place. So that's actually, that painting has him. So it's a little hard to come by some images of him, but I did get many. I found some, you know, little towns in Italy had little engravings of him and things like that.
Dumas, the author, had his share of racism as he was a target of the media, depicting him to be a savage and challenged because of his success as a black man in the 1800s.
So when he actually became really famous and had published his great books and was maybe the most famous author in the world at the time, within France, all the descriptions of him that you can find in the newspapers from the time are very racist. They're filled with sort of racist cliches, and they're caricatures of him as a kind of savage cannibal eating his white characters, and sort of horrible caricature of him with huge lips and the bone through his nose, and he's boiling the Three Musketeers alive. And so by that point, he was really singled out and insulted as a black man who had no right to be so famous.
Reese's book, The Black Count, Glory, Revolution, Betrayal, and the Real Count of Monte Cristo, is in stores now. I'm L.C. Morris.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with CCHC Imaging Center, introducing 3D mammography to this region, offering earlier detection of small breast cancers, accuracy in pinpointing size, shape, and location, plus fewer biopsies and additional testing. Online at cchealthcare.com. From now until April 15th, AARP is offering a free tax preparation service for low to moderate income taxpayers, especially those 60 and older. The program is in locations all across eastern North Carolina. Stephen O'Connell spoke with one of the certified volunteers from the New Bern location. Alexander Munster, a volunteer of 11 years, tells us what to expect.
Mr. Munster, what kind of training did you guys get so that you could do this?
The tax aid volunteers are all certified by the IRS, basically prepare a range of income tax returns and in order to qualify, and they have to qualify through a range of basic, intermediate, and then advanced tax returns. So from a simple return to a more complex return. So we can do things like brokerage statements, retirement plans, energy tax credits, education credits, the more sophisticated return.
When people are going to be coming in, what do they need to bring?
The best thing to do is bring your last year's return, or the last year you filed a return, and then all, you know, your 1040 information, your W-2 forms, your 1099s, your interest, your dividends. Important if you have dependents, not only yours, but their Social Security cards, any child or dependent care, because there's additional tax credits you can get with those. Anything for your health savings, any medical that you've paid for, cash, long-term health insurance. These things are all deductible.
How many came in last year?
Last year, I think we did probably maybe 650. We can even do prior year returns. Or if you filed and you had a mistake in a return, we can do amended returns.
I wanted to ask you about something I read recently. It was advice that told me that I shouldn't worry so much about getting that chunk of money from the government that you get at the beginning of the year.
What's interesting about that is people tend to overpay their taxes. There are deductions that come out of either your W-2 or your retirement 1099s. They take Social Security dollars out of their retirement money and their Social Security money. And at the end of the year, then they get back maybe, let's just say, they get back $500 or $1,000. They really should adjust the percentage of monies coming out so they don't give the government money to hold for them until the end of the year. I mean, we counsel them that, you know, they don't have to be, you know, some people like to get $1,000 back at the end of the year, but that's $1,000 you didn't have all during the year, and you're not getting any interest on it. So we can help them either have the Social Security take less out or have their 1099 retirement fund people, wherever it's coming from, take less out. And, of course, there's some cases where they owe. And the reverse is true. Better idea at the end is just to come out as close to zero, I don't owe you and you don't owe me type of thing. Then you know you've got it done right.
I'm speaking with Tax Aid Program volunteer Alexander Munster. Thank you for speaking with me.
All right, have a good day.
The free Tax Aid Program takes place across eastern North Carolina from now until April 15th, including Carteret, Craven, Onslow, Pitt, and Wayne counties. To find an AARP tax aid program near you, visit publicradioeast.org. I'm Stephen O'Connell.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Well, the temperatures are dropping. If you haven't already had them, you'll be getting frost warnings soon, and then freeze warnings. If you have a vegetable garden, you need to really pay attention to these, depending on what you have planted out there. Let's talk first about the difference between a frost and a freeze. In order to talk about those, it's helpful to think about how warmth and coolness works on the Earth's surface. During the day, the sun shines down on the soil and plants and warms them up. And then at night, that warmth radiates away from the plants. On a really still night, when there's no wind, you actually can have plants that lose heat faster than the air around them. As a result, the plant's surface can freeze, even if the air around it is slightly above a freezing temperature. This is what happens in a frost. Now, anything that keeps that warmth from radiating away from the plant surface can prevent the frost. That's why on a night with a heavy cloud cover, you don't get a frost. Only on a clear night with no clouds to hold that warmth down. You can also stop the heat from radiating away with some type of cover over your garden, whether it's built like a little greenhouse cover or just a floating row cover, light fabric that you place over your plants. Either one may prevent frost. So now we understand frost. What's the difference with a freeze? Well, a freeze is actually a large air mass of below freezing temperatures moving into the area. It generally comes with winds more than 5 miles an hour, and it is usually much thicker cold air above the plant surface. And you get an actual deep freeze of the plant tissue rather than just a coating of frozen moisture on the surface of the plant. Well, what happens? How does a freeze kill plant tissue? First of all, remember that the plant is made up of a lot of water, and there's water inside each bit of that plant. When the water inside freezes, it causes ice crystals that pierce the cell walls of the plant. And then when the temperature warms up, the cells leak out their fluids and the plants die and turn to mush. Pay attention to the warnings in your area. And if you have crops that need to be protected in your vegetable garden, now's a good time to think about getting the materials to protect them. If you have lettuce or other vegetables that are very tolerant to cool temperatures, if not heavy freezes, those are the great ones to protect, to extend the season and keep them growing throughout the winter. Other vegetables like kale and collards, all of the hardy winter vegetables, and there's a lot of them here on the coast, they go all winter long without needing any help from you. We just don't get cold enough to cause them much damage most years. Sometimes you'll get a little freeze damage on the leaves, but the plant keeps going. So pay attention to the frost and freeze dates. Now that you know the difference, take care of what you need to in your garden. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.